meeting is being recorded.
Right. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
And it sounds like our connections have been checked. Ms. Johnson, you're able to hear us?
I am. Thank you.
Very good. Okay. Well, good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I will ask the marshal to call us in.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfield, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfield presiding.
And again, good morning. Welcome. As you can tell by the notice and the way things are proceeding today, we're going ahead with this hearing via video technology. We have five matters pending on our calendar today. Two of those are by oral argument. And I see the attorneys for the first case before me today. So I'll ask the marshal to call the first case, and then I'll have just a few comments before we go ahead with the argument.
Case number A21-1044, Andrew Joseph Lee, petitioner appellant versus Brittany K. Lee, now known as Brittany K. Moore, respondent.
All right. And before we go ahead, I just want to say that a couple of things, and they're really just reminders for the lawyers. We are recording today's proceedings. There will be an audio recording made available on the court's website. That's the only thing that's allowed. So no other recording is allowed. One thing that we ask in order to keep our record clear is that the lawyers, before they begin their remark, identify themselves for the record as well as the client you represent. And then the clock should be visible to you on your screen. If it's not, you need to say something right away. And please keep your eye on the clock. We really look forward to these conversations, but they tend to go quickly. So we encourage you to just keep your eye on the timing. That said, we are ready to go ahead. So counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Bridget Rose Landry, and I'm the attorney for the appellant, Andrew Joseph Lee, in this matter. May it please the court, appellant is seeking reversal of the district court's decision to modify physical custody. Appellant is seeking to have the custody and parenting time set forth in the party's November 23rd, 2015 judgment and decree reinstated, as respondent did not meet her burden of establishing the four elements necessary to modify physical custody. There is no legal evidence or support on the record to support the district court's decision to modify custody and child support. Minnesota law has consistently held that modifications of physical custody are governed by Minnesota Statute 518.18D, which is commonly referred to as the endangerment standard. The party seeking to modify custody bears the burden of establishing all four factors under the statute, and the district court must make specific findings addressing each factor. Under the law, respondent is first required to show a substantial change in circumstances that causes the child actual adverse effects. Second, that it is in her best interest to change custody. Third, that the child's present environment endangers her physical or emotional health or impairs her emotional development. And fourth, that the harm likely to be caused by a change of environment is outweighed by the advantage of a change to the child. Failure to meet each and every factor is fatal to a custody modification. Even if this court determines appropriate findings were made that there is a substantial change in circumstances and modification is necessary to serve the best interests of the child, quote, the court still must retain the custodian established by the prior order unless the child's present environment endangers the child's physical or emotional health or emotional development and the advantage of a change outweighs the harm likely to be caused by the change. And that's Rordance v. Rordance, 438 Northwest 2nd, 687 at page 690, Minnesota Court of Appeals, 1989. It is our position that respondent did not meet her burden of establishing any of the four factors, and the district court abused its discretion. With each one of these factors, there is evidence the district court ignored or made findings contrary to the evidence. Appellant's brief and reply brief.
Let me ask you a question, though. It seemed to me that your argument is really one of asking us to reweigh the evidence. Why is that not what you're doing? I mean, there is evidence in the record to support each of the findings. So saying there's no evidence, I mean, the grandparents testified that the child's behavior had changed and they'd never seen that before. I mean, that is evidence. So what? Why is that the wrong take on your argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. So in this case, we're not asking to reweigh the evidence. What we're saying is that there is actual evidence that contradicts the grandparents' lay witness testimony. So when you look at the therapy records of the child, which the district court completely ignored, it shows that Mackenzie had always had a history of dealing with anxiety related to exchanges between
her
parents.
But not banging things around on the walls. I read through all the therapy records and I didn't see that one way or the other. And so keep going. I guess there's not a question there, but keep going.
Well, just to your point, Your Honor, the judgment and decree and Ms. Lee's testimony at the 2015 trial included specifics that Mackenzie would act out because she didn't know how to verbalize her stress and anxiety, including throwing her head back when it was time for exchanges. So this is something that Ms. Lee had noticed since the 2015 trial. And it's not a change of how she reacts to stress or anxiety. And if you further note in the therapy records, it's specifically noted, and Mackenzie even endorses, that the anxiety is related to changes. And if you look at the timing of when Ms. Lee said she had never noticed Mackenzie's reaction, which is contradicted by the decree, Mackenzie had just come back from an exchange with her mother. And it was a summer after the prior exchange when she didn't see her mother for 6 months because her mother canceled or couldn't afford to come on visits. So there is a pattern of Mackenzie dealing with anxiety for transitions, and it has nothing to do with appellant's move or appellant's home environment with Mackenzie. And further, the records actually do not support that appellant's home was causing Mackenzie's or anxiety. And I think you also have to look at the timing of this. The judgment and decree specifically noted that appellant would be moving from his parents' home after the divorce was final and things had settled down. He did exactly that. Less than 3 years after the decree, he moved. And this was less than 2 years before respondent brought her motion. So to claim an event that had happened 2 years prior is now causing anxiety or endangerment into Mackenzie is not supported by the record. And furthermore, it's important to note that when there is actual
counsel, if I could just, and I don't mean to stop you from explaining your response to Judge Siegel, because it's an important question, but it seems to me one of the aspects of the district court's findings that you're overlooking, and I know you do touch on it in your brief, but so the district court, you know, having heard all of these witnesses and had the opportunity to make determinations about credibility and strength of testimony, district court credited the grandparents' testimony about the nature of the breakdown of the relationship between father and his own parents, the paternal grandparents. I realize that you questioned that and articulated, you know, father's testimony articulated other reasons for the breakdown. But, you know, the district court, like I said, was there to hear the witnesses and has a different take on that and attributes it largely to father. And you're right, some changes in circumstances that were somewhat anticipated in the 2015 decree and that father was going to move out. But exactly how he moved out and the changes in everyone's relationships, including his own with Mackenzie, you know, those are the findings that the district court was really in the best position to make. And so I'm struggling with how you're analyzing the record along the same lines as what Judge Siegel mentioned. So maybe you can help me out.
Yes, thank you for that question. So what the district court ignored was actual documentation that set forth the timeline and the change in relationships with appellant. So yes, while the lay witnesses did testify as to their opinions about the reason for Mackenzie's behavior, there's actual text messages between appellant and his parents that show that they were the ones that cut off the contact, that this was done almost 2 years after he had moved out of the house. In between that, you have the pandemic. and other things. So while the district court does have a large swath with which to review and weigh evidence, there's also case law that says when there is actual proof or documentation supporting a fact, it is clear error to disregard evidence or testimony supporting that fact and instead find the testimony is not credible. And that's in Turay v. Allied Enterprises Incorporated, 256 Northwest 2nd, 71, Minnesota, 1977. And that's what we have here. So if you, yes, this is what the grandparents testified to, but if you look at the text message, Mackenzie's therapy records and Mackenzie's school records, they show that any of her behavioral or anxiety is not related to appellant's home. And furthermore, relationships with grandparents, while it is a best interest consideration, there is no case law to say that a changed relationship with a grandparent is endangerment or a substantial change in circumstances. Case law has consistently held that it is the it's preferred that the child be with the custodial parent. And what the district court did in this case is effectively state that Mackenzie's relationship is more important with her grandparents than it is with appellant himself. And if you look at the actual therapy records, which is in Exhibit 6 and which was not considered by the court, it shows that Mackenzie defines her family and her support system as her father, stepmother, stepsister, and stepbrother in Minnesota. And if you look
I'm concerned, Ms. Landry, is it your position that there any of the evidence that is not specifically referenced by the district court was therefore not considered by the district court? It seems like in a case like this, as a former district court judge, it seems like there's always a bunch of evidence and documents and text messages and all the rest of it. But a district court judge can't hardly be expected to reject every single thing that's inconsistent with the findings that the district judge makes. I'm a little confused. Is that your view, that the district judge has to mention every piece of evidence and reject it?
No, Your Honor, that's not my view at all. What I'm saying is that the district court basically ignored the actual evidence, the evidence of experts regarding endangerment and adverse effects on the child.
How can we tell from the district court's order, how can we tell that the district court ignored it and instead of finding other evidence to be more persuasive?
I believe that it's clear that the district court ignored it, because if you look at the actual therapy records or even the expert testimony, it contradicts some of the findings that the district court made, such as, the district court in this case made no mention of the importance that Mackenzie places on her relationship with appellant and living with him. The district court made contradictory findings that appellant's probation violation could result in endangerment when the actual evidence shows he was in full compliance. The school records showing that there's no drop in school performance, no drop in grades. The fact that the district court specifically found that appellant changed Mackenzie's school when the school records show that her school never changed. The fact that the therapy records show that respondent participated in therapy, contacting the therapist, and the actual evidence showed that respondent agreed to change her therapist, whereas the district court made a finding that he did it unilaterally. So there's multiple examples, and they are pointed out in my brief, that the district court made findings that contradict.
Where in the record is it that respondent actually agreed to the change in therapist prior to the change?
So Exhibit 2.
I didn't see that. I saw her calling the clinic once she found out that therapy was ongoing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was therapy occurring, but I didn't. Can you cite me to the record for that?
Yes, Your Honor. Exhibit 2, which is the party's binding mediation agreement, they specifically agreed to change Mackenzie's therapist to a female therapist.
And then did she participate in the selection of that therapist?
Yes, she did, Your Honor.
How? When? I mean, where's that in the record?
So that is in the record in the therapy records, because it shows that her therapist was switched to the
All right, thanks. Okay, continue on with your argument.
And the district court also made repeated findings that respondent could better support Mackenzie's mental health and emotional development by ensuring that she regularly attended therapy. And when you look at the actual therapy records, what it shows is that she ensured Mackenzie attended 3.5 appointments in the span of 20 weeks, canceling appointments, not providing Mackenzie with a fully charged device. Mackenzie went 5 to 8 weeks between therapy appointments when the recommendation was every 2 to 3 weeks. So that's also established by the therapy records. But I also want to point out that one of the main things that the district court overlooked in this case, in addition to having no actual adverse effects on Mackenzie, is the harm that it would cause Mackenzie by changing her life in Minnesota. So she had been living in Minnesota for the past 7 years, primarily with appellant. And when the district court determined that the harm of the change in that was outweighed by the benefits to Mackenzie, what it specifically stated was just that the harm was that appellant would lose custody. He boiled down Mackenzie's last 7 years of life into one sentence. The harm was that appellant would lose custody. The district court didn't talk about how it would change her therapy, change her school, change her complete living environment. And I think that that also shows that the district court ignored the evidence that was provided to show that there is no endangerment, that the harm would be outweighed. And respondent failed to meet her burden on each of those factors. And even if you agree that the district court found it was in Mackenzie's best interest, there still has to be evidence showing endangerment, showing actual adverse effects on Mackenzie. And if you look at the therapy records and the school records, there is none. There is no change to her behavior after the move into appellant's house. There is no change or drop in grades. There is nothing to show she's had substantial adverse effects or any sort of endangerment. And case law is very clear that there must be actual endangerment in the present environment to change custody. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So we are resetting the clock for respondent. There it is. So counsel for respondent, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Jill Johnson-Bigelbach on behalf of the respondent in this case. Your Honor, I would just like to start by recognizing that we're here today because of a 10-year-old little girl. When she began having difficulty with her living arrangement, being exposed to things that she shouldn't, the people that love her in her life, her parents, her grandparents, her extended family, and this court needed to step up and help her make changes that would help to serve her better in the long run. And so that's what we're here to talk about today. I'd like to first just address the standard of reviews in this case. The standard of review for the district court's determination of a modification of custody is abuse of discretion, and that standard does afford the district court broad discretion. In an appeal, this standard places the burden on the appellant to show that the district court made findings unsupported by the evidence or misapplied the law. It's not enough for the appellant to demonstrate that he doesn't agree with the court's decision or that the court should have weighed the evidence differently. He has to show that the evidence does not support it by the actual record in this case. Appellant has not done that in the instant case. The other significant standard of review to apply in this case is the standard applied to factual findings and credibility determinations, and that's clearly erroneous. Your Honors, especially in family law cases, which are fact heavy and have to be considered on a case-by-case basis, that standard of review is important because the court has found that the district court is really in the unique position to weigh the evidence as it comes in to the record and make determinations from there. And so this court has found that it's not in a position to reweigh the evidence for the district court, but to confirm that evidence exists to support the decision. And again, the appellant in this case has just failed to meet the burden of proof or standard. Your Honor, the issue on appeal is whether or not a modification of custody is appropriate from appellant who lives in Minnesota to respondent who lives in Texas.
So let me just interject with a question. How do you respond to appellant's argument that the district court just put too much weight on the relationship with the child's paternal grandparents? I mean, she points out there is no you know, right under the law, even to rights to visitation, for example. And it seems like this district court was just heavily influenced by the dispute going on between dad and his parents. So, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So what's your response to that?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, I understand that is the argument, but I do think that appellant is really oversimplifying what these changes in her relationship with her grandparents meant for this kid. I mean, this child had lived with these grandparents for a long time. They were a huge source of emotional support for this child. So to make that change for this child was significant and was a change for this child. And where it's relevant is not with respect to the grandparents' rights in this case, but how the changes impacted this particular child and how then her behavior changed as a result of that. Your Honor, that first element of the statute is whether or not there has been a change in circumstance. And I want to just point out to the court that the element is whether or not there has been a change, singular. Okay. In this case, the court found that there had been multiple changes for this child. And I point that out just to say that even in we believe that the court was correct in how he weighed the evidence. But even if this court here finds that one of these factors does not meet a substantial change, as long as there is one substantial change, this element of the statute has been met. And again, the district court found multiple changes for this child. Perhaps the most significant was to her living arrangement. Again, this child lived with her grandparents and appellant for the first about 7 years of her life. And the district court really focused on how appellant chose to change that for her.
He moved in. What is the best evidence for your client in terms of this having an actual adverse effect on the child?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the best evidence for our client is really the testimony of 4 out of the 5 people who know this child the best. If you look at the people that really know this child and have known this child all her life, it would be her parents, her paternal grandparents that she lived with, and then her maternal step-grandmother. Okay. Out of those 5 people, 4 of those people testified that they saw behavioral changes and had some concerns with this child's emotional distress after some of these changes were instituted by appellant. So 4 out of the 5 major people in this child's life, people who knew her the best, testified that a modification of custody was appropriate and necessary for this child. And I will note that, yes, there are therapy records and appellant has referenced that in Exhibit 6. But I would like to point out that my client was not advised when that child was placed into that therapeutic situation. She was enrolled in early September. They did an intake on September 27th, which my client did not participate in. And the record shows that information was given about her to the therapist that was not correct. And then thereafter, after that first session, she was able to have contact with the therapist. And I'd just like to point out that that really colors.
How long after, Ms. Jansen?
I'm sorry?
How long after
that initial intake? The initial intake. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
How long after the initial intake was your client?
The child was enrolled on September 13th, or at least before then, because there's a letter indicating that the child was enrolled. The intake was on September 27th. The parties happened to be going to mediation and attended mediation on September 30th, but the intake had already happened. The information had already been provided.
And so it was a matter of days.
Yes. And then the record shows that my client made contact with the therapist in early October. But I would like to point out that this really is a pattern or a sustained pattern in course of conduct for the appellant. He enrolled and disenrolled the child in therapy in 2017 without any knowledge or involvement of my client. She found out about that from the child. Then in 2019, he again enrolled without advising my client. And then the record does show that he decided with the minor child that she would no longer see the therapist in 2019 and that she'd see a female therapist. And you can see in March of that year, my client reaching out via our family wizard and saying, it's my understanding that you told the child that she's not going to be seeing a female therapist. Why haven't you communicated that to me? And he was very dismissive in his response. So then later, when the parties attended mediation in May of that year, is when they discussed an appropriate female therapist. But that change had been made by that time. There are other changes, and I would just like to point out that one of appellant's argument is that there was not adverse effects to this child and that there was no endangerment shown. And I'd just like to give a list of some of the adverse effects for this child. The paternal grandmother testified that she really wasn't seeing any anxiety for this child until she moved out. And then the anxiety really started to ramp up for this child. She noted major anxiety and anger issues due to the move, and she asked her son to slow down with the transition and allow the child some time. She noted that the child was very sad because appellant and his wife were talking poorly about her mother. She noted she had anxiety about staying alone with appellant's girlfriend. And then in fall of 2019, paternal grandmother said, again, she noted the child was having anger issues because she didn't like her current living situation and she wanted to live with her mommy. And that's on day 3 of the testimony, pages 198 and 199. Paternal grandmother noted that she'd never seen the child angry like this before, that she'd go throughout the house and knock things down, that she took a bat and was hitting the steps, that she'd never seen those behavioral reactions in this child before. Paternal grandfather also noted some of these changes and that there was a change in demeanor for this child. She was no longer the bubbly child that she had once been. The step-grandmother noted that during the summer visitation, she noticed behavioral changes in the child, and the child was very defensive and angry and noted some behavioral issues. So there are adverse effects that the district court considered and noted in this record that supported his finding that there was a change in circumstances that endangered the emotional health and development of this child. The court also noted other changes in circumstances, which included the child having access to sexually explicit materials while in father's care, and that he wasn't providing proper supervision, so she was able to access that material. He had 2 criminal convictions, both of which involved alcohol, and the second of which involved a child and a firearm.
So, counsel, let's just take those 2 examples. Would you draw out for me what the record shows as to the adverse effects on Mackenzie of those 2 incidences? So, and I'm grouping together the 2 convictions and then secondly, the sexually explicit material.
Okay. Your Honor, the court found with respect to the criminal convictions that the court has concerns about appellant's parenting capacity because he was involved in 2 situations, both of which involved alcohol and one of which involved a firearm and a minor child. And that then would speak to his ability to make good decisions moving forward. The other issue is that appellant was on probation, and part of his probation condition was that he would relinquish firearms. And the court found that his testimony was not credible with respect to whether or not he'd actually done so. He represented that he gave those firearms to his parents. His parents testified that no, they had not received them and did not have them. And so that caused pause for this district court, that if he was in violation of a probation condition, he certainly could end up being incarcerated, or the child could be in danger if there was a firearm in a home of somebody who had found to be negligent with respect to a firearm, alcohol, and a child. With respect to the sexually explicit material, the court again found this to be really moving to the appellant's parenting capacity. The child access the sexually explicit material. He did not tell mother that this had happened so that she could watch out for it, took the parental locks off of the device again, and the child accessed the information again. And the court found that, again, this goes to his lack of supervision and his lack of providing appropriate parenting to this child, and that she could be impacted and may be impacted by having access to this sexually explicit material. Your Honor, the second element of the analysis that I just want to touch upon briefly is the best interest of the child standard. And that really is to be judged against a clearly erroneous standard. And I will say there are 12 best interests of the child factors. And in this case, the determination that, you know, the evidence weighs factor of a change of custody, it wasn't even a close call. 9 of the factors the court determined favored a modification of custody, and 3 of the factors the court determined were neutral. Not one of the factors did the court find favored the child remaining in the custody of the respondent. Your Honors, again, with the third element, which is whether or not this child is in danger, this court has held that the existence of endangerment must be determined on a particular facts of each case. But the endangerment may affect only the child's emotional.
Can I ask just one more quick question? I know when the father was, appellant was assessed for chemical use, that there was a recommendation that he attend 8 outpatient sessions. Is there anything in the record about whether that occurred or not?
Your Honor, I don't have that information available. And instead of giving you, you know, the
no,
wrong...
No, no, no. I just want things that are actually in the record. Okay,
not
thank
that
you.
I know of. Okay. Again, this court has recognized that a sustained course of conduct by one parent designed to diminish a child's relationship with the other parent may constitute endangerment. And the court does look to the child's behavioral problems to determine whether or not that standard has been met. And I would just like to say that a loyalty bind can also create some of those problems for this child and can cause endangerment, as it has in this case. See, my time is up. So thank you.
Thank you, counsel. So we are resetting the clock for rebuttal. There we go. Counsel for appellant, you can begin your rebuttal when you're ready. Well, counsel, I think you are still muted. So if you
sorry. thank you, Your Honors. Briefly regarding the convictions, there was evidence that appellant was in full compliance with probation. Exhibit 24 is from his probation officer and the court records showing full compliance. There was never any violations. Exhibit 25 are his medical records showing that he was in full compliance with probation and had not been diagnosed with any sort of physical, mental, or chemical health issues. And it did show that he, in fact, attended those required outpatient sessions as part of his probation, which is also why the probation officer noted he was in full compliance. In re, the custody of CAM has held that there was not endangerment for a single child neglect charge with no conviction, as it was an isolated incident occurring almost 1 year before mother's motion and did not provide any indication that the underlying factors leading to the neglect charge continued at present. And that's A19-1093, 2020 Minnesota Court of Appeals, unpublished. Further, Minnesota case law has stated that an alleged single incident of borderline abuse or neglect has been held not to constitute sufficient endangerment to warrant a custody modification. And that's Gieb v. Gieb, 571 Northwest 2nd, 774 at 779. In this case, the actual records show that Mackenzie did not experience any sort of mental or emotional harm resulting from appellant's isolated incidents. And the court said prospectively that a probation violation could endanger her. There is no place in the endangerment analysis for a prospective finding. It has to be shown that her present environment actually endangers her. And when you look at the therapy records and the school records, that is not shown. Furthermore, Mackenzie's two isolated internet searches, the first of which appellant addressed appropriately by putting
counsel, I apologize, but I'd like you to go back for a second in terms of your discussion of the criminal convictions, because it seems to me you're not directly addressing the argument, and I'd like to hear your response to respondent's argument about the storage of firearms and the district court's explicit, determination that he did not find the evidence credible or sufficient to that father is in careful compliance with requirements about keeping firearms away from the children and, in fact, out of his house.
So the district court again relied on lay witness testimony, ignoring the probation officer's report that he was in full compliance. The grandparents did actually have some of appellant's firearms. That was established on the record. The majority of them was moved to his mother-in-law's house by appellant's wife, and that is also on the record. So the district court instead ignored the actual documentation from his probation officer showing he's been in full compliance, ignored his testimony and his wife's testimony who transported the firearms, and instead adopted the testimony of the grandparents who had no personal knowledge of the transportation or the probation compliance.
This is actually one instance where the district court did make a specific finding rejecting the testimony of the father and his wife. It said he didn't believe them.
Yes, I do understand that, but the actual records from the probation officer show that he was in full compliance. And I think that has to override the lay witness testimony. And case law supports that. Those probation records directly.
Do you know is there something in that probation officer record showing that he inspected their cabin and house, et cetera, to verify that? Or was he just taking it on the word of the appellant?
So the records specifically state that he is in full compliance. And I would actually also note that July 2019 incident, Mackenzie was in Texas. She was not present for it. It was not at appellant's home. It was at his grandparents' cabin where they often keep firearms. It wasn't
and
even his
And he had an AR-15 right next to him, right? And he was so drunk with a three-year-old present who he was responsible for that the neighbors called. I mean, that's what's in your own client's affidavit, correct?
I believe that mischaracterizes what actually happened. So yes, there was an AR-15 in the kitchen, but the child, who is not the child in this case, was not with the appellant. He was with the neighbors being watched by the neighbors.
Well, the neighbors took the child is what your client's affidavit says, is what appellant's affidavit says. But anyway, let's finish up your argument. I'm sorry.
Well, I see I'm out of time. I just would respectfully note that there was an expert who has over 33 years of experience with child abuse and neglect who testified that Mackenzie's isolated internet searches are normal for children of her age and are not endangerment. And the district court also ignored that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both lawyers.